Hitler kept Germany neutral during this war, but he offered no backing to the League. Mussolini needed friends. Hitler could use them. In January 1936, Mussolini shifted ground. He signalled that Stresa was dead in his view, that he wouldn't oppose Austria falling under German sway, and that he would offer no support to France and Britain should Hitler wish to react to the ratification, forthcoming in Paris, of the Mutual Assistance Pact with the Soviet Union. Hitler was alert. It meant that he could contemplate an early move to remilitarize the Rhineland, an essential step in German Western defense and important for rearmament, but a flagrant assault on the Locarno Treaty of 1925 that had guaranteed the post-war settlement in Western Europe. Sooner or later, any nationalist German government would have sought to remove the stipulation of the post-war settlement, endorsed at Locarno, that a 50-kilometer strip of German territory on the right bank of the Rhine should remain demilitarized. To most Germans, not just extreme nationalists, this amounted to an intolerable limit on German sovereignty and the lasting stigma of the Victor's Diktat of 1919. The likelihood is that patient diplomacy would have negotiated an end to the demilitarization over the next couple of years. Hitler himself had 1937 in mind, but patient diplomacy wasn't Hitler's way. He saw the big advantages to his domestic prestige as well as international standing of a dramatic coup. The ratification of the Franco-Soviet Pact offered the pretext. The disarray of the Western democracies over Abyssinia, the loss of credibility of the League of Nations, and Mussolini's green light provided the opportunity. The moment had to be seized. There was some last-minute hesitation and nervousness, but Hitler didn't waver for long. On the 7th of March 1936, a force of 22,000 German troops entered the demilitarized zone. A mere 3,000 men out of the assembled force of 30,000 troops had been ordered to advance deep into the Rhineland, backed by police units. There was no military confrontation. As Hitler had guessed, the Western democracies protested after the event, but otherwise did nothing. He had got away with his biggest triumph to date. This proved the last chance, short of war, for the Western democracies to stop Hitler in his tracks. Why didn't they do so? After all, only a small German force advanced into the Rhineland, and with orders to retreat if challenged by the biggest army in Western Europe. If the French had stopped the advancing troops with a show of military force, the blow to Hitler's standing would have significantly weakened him in the eyes of the German military and public. What the consequences might have been is impossible to know. It's distinctly feasible that Hitler may well have proved incapable of pushing ahead with subsequent moves, seen by powerful figures in the military leadership as reckless and dangerous, had he failed ignominiously in attempting to remilitarize the Rhineland in 1936. However, as Hitler knew from what had been gleaned from French intelligence, there was little chance of France taking military measures to stop the German action. French politicians had, before Hitler's move, all but ruled out the use of force to remove German troops from the Rhineland. Mobilization would have been financially and politically disastrous at a cost of 30 million francs a day. Even as it was, financial panic in Paris was only narrowly averted. Moreover, France's army wasn't capable of immediate action. It needed a 16-day period of mobilization, and this was to defend France's borders, not to fight on the Rhine. French public opinion was also opposed to military retaliation. Even those who wanted to see Hitler punished didn't think the Rhineland worth fighting for. In any case, the French were unwilling to act without British support. There was, however, no chance of any British backing for military action over the Rhineland. British leaders were well aware and made it clear to the French that Britain was in no position to take military action against Germany in the event of a breach of the Locarno Treaty. British opinion would certainly not have favoured any such action. The mood in Britain in the wake of the Abyssinian crisis was, if anything, more anti-French than anti-German. There was absolutely no appetite for taking on Hitler when, after all, in the eyes of so many people, he was simply entering his own backyard. In contrast with British popular reactions to the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, there were no protest marches, demonstrations, or demands for sanctions against Germany. So neither Britain nor France did anything beyond trying to cover up their own disagreements about how to proceed, wring their hands, appeal to the League of Nations Council, a move certain to cause Hitler sleepless nights, and eventually put forward half-hearted diplomatic proposals for a settlement of the Rhineland question, which Hitler, having already settled matters in his own way, had no difficulty in rejecting. Anthony Eden, by now British Foreign Secretary, told the House of Commons that his objective had been to seek a peaceful and agreed solution. "It is the appeasement of Europe as a whole that we have constantly before us," he stated. Appeasement was a term that would soon come back to haunt the British government. At the end of March 1936, Hitler staged a plebiscite to ratify the Rhineland action. It brought him the 99% vote of support so dear to dictators. Of course, it was a contrived result, but there can be no doubt that in reality, an overwhelming proportion of the German population enthusiastically welcomed Hitler's move, certainly once it was clear that it wouldn't lead to war. The dictator's popularity at home soared to new heights. This boosted his dominance over the traditional German ruling elites. His boldness had paid off. Their doubts had proven to be mistaken. The army, in particular, was further beholden to Hitler. The dictator's own egomania knew no bounds. He thought himself practically infallible, while for those who had wavered during the tense days preceding the march into the Rhineland, he had nothing but contempt. Germany's military strength now unquestionably constituted the supreme factor in the European constellation of power. It was an astonishing turnaround from the situation a mere 4 years earlier, when, with the country on its knees, the Western powers had agreed to the effective termination of reparations. The remilitarization of the Rhineland gave the coup de grace to the Versailles and Locarno treaties, and finally demolished lingering hopes of a lasting basis of security on the Franco-German borders. A confrontation of the Western democracies with Hitler's Germany at some point seemed ever more likely. Over the past 3 years, Hitler had repeatedly grasped the initiative, while the Western powers had dithered, revealing only weakness and lack of resolve. As Britain and France continued to try to wrestle with diplomatic partners who didn't play by established rules, the dictators of Germany and Italy edged closer together. At the beginning of 1936, relations between the two had still been far less than cordial. By the autumn, the creation of what Mussolini, on the 1st of November, proclaimed as the Roma-Berlin Axis, was forged. Mussolini, though he didn't yet see it, was moving from senior dictator to junior partner. The two expansionist powers, each ruled by unpredictable leaders wielding near absolute power in their countries, posed a mounting dual threat to Europe's peace. Now, deprived of Italian support, Austria had agreed in July to terms that heavily increased German influence on the country. And even before it had been formally constituted, the Axis was at work in Spain. Both Hitler and Mussolini had already decided to provide military support to the nationalist rebellion against the Spanish Republic, led by General Francisco Franco. A significant factor in bringing the dictators closer together was anti-Bolshevism. Hitler was here plainly the driving force. For Mussolini, anti-Bolshevism had been in the main a propaganda weapon at home. Russia was of little strategic importance to him. Hitler's anti-Bolshevism was more radical. The intrinsic link in his mind between Jews and Bolshevism had been a personal obsession since the 1920s. But the Soviet Union had played at best a subordinate role in shaping his moves in foreign policy since taking power. This was changing in 1936. In that year, the notion of a coming showdown with the key ideological foe, something that had never left Hitler's mind, started to solidify. He was becoming preoccupied by the Bolshevik threat. Hitler saw real danger for Germany arising from possible communist domination in France and Spain. He was well aware of the big advances in industrialization in the Soviet Union and the plans for extensive rearmament. Time, in his view, wasn't on Germany's side. He saw Europe as divided between two irreconcilable camps. The danger had to be confronted at some point over the next few years, before it was too late. By the end of August 1936, Hitler had completed a lengthy memorandum laying down the direction of the German economy over the following 4 years, stipulating a program aimed at maximizing domestic production geared towards a rapid acceleration of rearmament. The background was the mounting economic pressure within Germany over previous months. Food imports had temporarily taken priority over imports of raw materials needed for rearmament. Prominent voices were pressing the leadership to curtail rearmament and reorientate the economy. A decision was needed. Hitler made it. He chose guns over butter. His reasoning was political, not economic. His memorandum on the four-year plan began by asserting that Bolshevism would be at the center of a new worldwide conflict. Even though it couldn't be known when it would take place, a showdown with the Soviet Union, he declared, was inevitable. He ended the memorandum by setting out two tasks. One, the German armed forces must be operational within 4 years. Two, the German economy must be fit for war within 4 years. It wasn't a timetable for war, but from now on, Germany couldn't free itself from the track on which it was travelling. Short of removing Hitler from power, there could be no reversal to a peacetime economy built upon international trade. The choice had been for an intensive program of economic autarky to build up armed strength in readiness for conflict. The points were set. The track led towards war. The dictators were starting to shape Europe's destiny. Dictatorship. Reactionary regimes. The 1930s were the decade of the dictators. Some dictatorships had been formed in the 1920s. Others would follow as occupation regimes in the 1940s. But the 1930s were the decade above all in which dictators thrived. By 1939, more Europeans lived under dictatorships than democracies. All dictatorships shared a number of features: the elimination or severe restriction of pluralist forms of political representation, limits on or abolition of personal freedoms, control over the mass media, the termination or strict limitation of any judicial independence, and heavy-handed repression of political dissidents through extended police powers. And all dictatorships resorted to forms of pseudo-representation. Apart from the Soviet Union, where dictatorship of the proletariat based its claim to legitimacy on class. Dictatorial regimes invariably asserted that they represented the nation or the people, that they embodied popular sovereignty and were acting in the national interest. Some form of national assembly or parliament, however rigged, controlled or manipulated, was normally retained. Actual power invariably resided, however, in the rule of a strong man, whose authority rested on the backing of the military and security forces. In all dictatorships, the role of the military was decisive. And apart from the Soviet Union, the military was, without exception, ideologically national conservative and vehemently anti-socialist in character. For most dictatorships, essentially negative aims of quelling internal unrest, restoring order, and sustaining the existing power of elites sufficed. They posed no international danger. The authoritarian regime, for example, established in Estonia in 1934 by the Prime Minister and former leader of the Farmers' Union, Konstantin Pats, had the declared aim, amid deep political unrest and parliamentary instability, of upholding internal security. The Veterans Union, VAPSID, a radical right-wing populist movement, quasi-fascist in character, was held responsible for the growing political disorder and banned. The election of its deputies was annulled, some of its leading members were arrested, and political demonstrations were forbidden. Some newspapers were silenced. Pats then dissolved parliament. Thereafter, oppositional activity was prohibited and national unity promoted through state-run propaganda. But there was no large-scale political persecution. No concentration camps were set up. The arts and literature weren't restricted, as long as they were not seditious. And there was even little interference with the judiciary. Pats called his regime directed democracy. It was distinctly less than democratic, but it was at most an undynamic dictatorship, and after the early clampdown, compared with most authoritarian regimes of the era, even relatively liberal. A relatively mild form of authoritarianism, in its early years at least, also existed in Poland. External forms of democracy had been retained after Marshal Piłsudski's coup of May 1926. A parliament, called the Sejm, pluralistic parties and trade unions continued to exist. The press remained relatively free. However, the executive power of the state was greatly strengthened. The strongman, Piłsudski himself, controlled government from his formal position as war minister. In 1930, over 5,000 political opponents were arrested and some of the more important severely maltreated in prison. With this notable exception, repression at that stage wasn't extensive. In March 1933, with Poland beset by economic crisis, the Sejm gave the government powers to rule by decree. Real power behind Piłsudski lay in the hands of the military. Leading governmental positions were held by those dubbed the colonels, all proven Piłsudski loyalists. Repression became sharper. A concentration camp was erected by presidential decree in 1934 in Bereza Kartuska. Internment for 3 months and a possible extension for 3 further months didn't require sentence by a court of law. The first prisoners in July 1934 were Polish fascists. Most internees before 1939 were, however, communists. In all, around 3,000 individuals were sent to the camp in the pre-war years. Around a dozen died there, appalling enough, though, compared with the victims of many authoritarian regimes, a small number. The authoritarian character of the state was confirmed in the new constitution of April 1935, which accorded wide powers to the president as head of state and greatly diminished any basis of parliamentary independence. Piłsudski's death shortly afterwards in May brought no fundamental change. Amid continued factionalism, political disunity and awareness of the growing threat from Nazi Germany, a big state-supportive organization labeled the Camp of National Unification was set up in 1937 and came to rally support for the dominant Polish figure in the later 1930s, General Edward Rydz-Śmigły, referred to as leader of the nation. Poland became more stridently nationalist, more virulently anti-Semitic, less tolerant of ethnic minorities. But ideology remained confined to little more than the vague aim of national unity. And a significant fascist movement didn't exist. There was nothing dynamic about this form of authoritarianism. No major attempt was made to mobilize the population. The regime was content to control society. It had no great ambitions to change it. Preservation of order, to serve primarily the interests of the conservative elites that had traditionally dominated Polish society, was enough. Mass mobilization remained a limited vehicle in most authoritarian dictatorships. In Greece, the distinctly uncharismatic General Ioannis Metaxas had no mass organization at his disposal. Before taking power in April 1936, he had enjoyed the support of no more than 4% of Greeks. However, with the backing of King George II, the monarchy had been restored in 1935, and the military, and amid serious political upheaval, bitter power struggles and parliamentary deadlock, he was able to establish a dictatorship in August 1936. The declared aim was to set up a government free of parties and factions to save Greece from communism. Parliament was dissolved, the constitution abolished, martial law declared, parties and oppositional organizations were suppressed, and political liberties curtailed. The military and police were strengthened. Several thousand prisoners were incarcerated in brutal prison camps. Metaxas tried to imitate fascist methods, creating a fascist-style national youth organization and staging big parades to glorify the leader. But there had been little fascist influence in Greece before Metaxas took power, and his attempts to mobilize a mass base of support along the lines of Italian fascism, plainly directed at forging a genuine base of personalized power, were a failure. Nor was there anything resembling a coherent ideology. Metaxas remained in power until his death in 1941, but he was wholly dependent upon the king and the military. His dictatorship was another variant of repressive authoritarianism that constrained and controlled, but didn't mobilize society, and it lacked any ideological drive. Most other interwar dictatorships shared similar features, shaped in each case by national determinants. In Hungary, Miklós Horthy's authoritarianism, coming increasingly under German influence during the 1930s, retained the outer trappings of a pluralist system, but in practice depended even more heavily than ever on the army and big landowners rather than the mobilized masses. The fascist mass party was viewed as a threat to the regime, not a basis of support. Its leader, Ferenc Szálasi, was imprisoned, and his movement, the Party of the National Will, then the Hungarian National Socialist Party, banned before again being permitted to operate, reconstituting itself in March 1939 as the Arrow Cross, and gaining a quarter of the votes cast in the elections of May that year. Even so, despite the growth of fascist influence and its own increasingly extreme nationalist and anti-Jewish colouring, Horthy's regime remained essentially undynamic, reactionary, not revolutionary. On the other side of Europe, Antonio Salazar's Portugal was possibly the least dynamic of all Europe's dictatorships. His new state, Estado Novo, founded in 1933, was based on a cooperative constitution that embodied the values of reactionary Catholicism. These, and sustaining the Portuguese colonial possessions overseas, more or less amounted to the sum of the vague unifying ideology of the regime. There was a restricted franchise, press censorship, a ban on strikes and lockouts, and the usual apparatus of repression, a political police and special courts, widespread denunciation, and a network of informers. A state-organized party, the National Union, a youth movement and a paramilitary organization, which used the fascist salute, provided mass backing for the regime. However, Salazar had no wish at all to become dependent on a fascist mass movement, and actually suppressed the national syndicalists, the fascist blue shirts. This most dull of dictators wanted no leadership cult, and also turned his back on assertive militarism and imperialist expansionism. His brand of conservative authoritarianism offered the sharpest contrast to Europe's dynamic dictatorships. Dynamic dictatorship, ideology and mass mobilization. Even for contemporaries, it was abundantly plain that three dictatorships, those of the Soviet Union, Italy and Germany, stood out from all the rest. By the mid-1930s, their ideological confrontation, that of Soviet Bolshevism facing Italian fascism and German National Socialism, was hardening visibly. The confrontation was by this time, as the leaders of the Western democracies recognized, taking Europe into a danger zone. The amber lights warning of increasing likelihood of European war were starting to flash brightly. None of the conventional authoritarian regimes posed a threat to European peace, but each of the three exceptional dynamic dictatorships, especially Stalin's Russia and Hitler's Germany, was viewed with mounting apprehension by the Western democracies. Many on the conservative right feared communism more than fascism or Nazism, and from the 1920s onwards started to bracket the regimes together, labelling them totalitarian, to distinguish them from merely authoritarian forms of rule. For most on the left, not just communists, it was a gross error to conflate Soviet communism with the regimes in Italy and Germany, which had to be seen as variants of a common evil, fascism. Undeniably, despite their ideological differences, there were notable similarities in the methods of rule of the three dynamic dictatorships. Their complete regimentation of society, their terrorization of opponents and minorities, their adulation of a leader, and their relentless mobilization by a monopoly party. They were different forms of a completely new, modern type of dictatorship, the complete antithesis to liberal democracy. They were all revolutionary, if by that term we understand a major political upheaval driven by the utopian aim of changing society fundamentally. Correspondingly, they all made, in principle, the practice varied, a total claim on the individual. They weren't content simply to use repression as a means of control, but sought to mobilize behind an exclusive ideology to educate people into becoming committed believers, to claim them soul as well as body. Each of the regimes was therefore dynamic in ways that conventional authoritarianism wasn't. But how alike in practice were these dictatorships? Stalinism, idealism, terror, and fear. By the mid-1930s, the Bolshevik system of rule had become Stalinism. Collective leadership, not altogether fictional in the early years of the Soviet system, had evaporated completely since Lenin's death in 1924. The factional struggles that had accompanied the last phase of the new economic policy and the introduction of the first five-year plan in 1928 had produced a clear winner. The self-styled dictatorship of the proletariat was turning into the dictatorship of Joseph Stalin. In 1936, a new Soviet constitution was promulgated, replacing the first constitution of 1924. Stalin proclaimed it the most democratic of all the constitutions in the world. It offered universal electoral franchise, civil rights, freedom of thought, the press, religion, organization and assembly, and guarantees of employment, all in accordance with the interests of the working people and for purposes of strengthening the socialist system. Seldom has a constitution lied so monumentally. In truth, the Soviet Union was by this time an utterly ruthless dictatorship based heavily upon fear, servility, and careerist ambition. Freedom, even in the limited way in which it had existed under Lenin's new economic policy, didn't exist, nor did any protection under the law. Soviet citizens were in practice fully exposed to the unlimited and arbitrary power of the state. This was the product, in the main, of the intensely forced process of breakneck industrialization and modernization imposed on a backward country, combined with growing fear of war and, not least, the extreme, autocratic, relentlessly brutal and outrightly paranoid proclivities of the ruler, Stalin himself. What happened during the first five-year plan between 1928 and 1932, at its heart the compulsory collectivization of the peasantry, was labelled by Stalin a revolution from above. By the end of 1932, the plan was proclaimed fulfilled, a triumph. Much had indeed been achieved, even if the statistics were often fabricated. But the plan had been pushed through by extreme coercion, and it had been massively unpopular, especially among the peasantry. Agricultural regions, most of the vast country, were impoverished. But in towns, too, there was much discontent. There were food shortages, a severe lack of housing and rising prices. Dissatisfaction was tangible at every level. Also, and not least within the Bolshevik Party, and among the ruling strata of party and state. Not all Bolshevik leaders, many of whom were veterans of the old Leninist times, approved of what Stalin was doing, or the way he was doing it. And many of them remembered the Stalin of Lenin's days, recalling him as no more than a mere acolyte of the great man, and far from his best-liked or most able underling. They knew the man before he had become elevated to something approaching the status of a demigod. For Stalin, that knowledge was less than comfortable. There was, however, not just dissent and opposition to what was happening. There was also idealism and commitment. The vast and rapid industrialization program mobilized millions across the Soviet Union. Countless party members and young communists being groomed for party activism in the youth movement. The Komsomol, in contrast to the youth movements in Italy and Germany, still at this time an elite body rather than the mass organization it was to become by the late 1930s, worked ceaselessly to spread the vision of a coming socialist utopia. Of course, the image of a united people striving to attain such a future paradise was contrived and could scarcely offer great compensation or comfort to the huge majority of the population struggling under the yoke of daily anxieties, material deprivation and oppression. Even so, there was no shortage of enthusiasts. Young urban workers, intellectuals, and Jews disproportionately drawn across Europe to socialism as a path to freedom from discrimination and persecution, were particularly likely to be attracted to the vision of the brave new world under construction. The enormous building projects, dams, power stations, the Moscow underground, even new cities such as Magnitogorsk in the Urals, were seen as a hugely positive, visible sign of an astonishing transformation that was underway, a tangible indicator of progress, of what Soviet society could produce. The idealism that participation in building the new utopia produced was not a phantasm. The feeling of integration in the building of a new society was coupled with real material here and now expectations, not just distant utopian advantages that commitment to the regime could bring. The immense mobilization behind the industrialization program demanded huge numbers of activists who could build careers, improve their living standards, and, not least, wield substantial power in their striving to make the system work. 500,000 party members were recruited between 1934 and 1939. Most were poorly educated and inexperienced. These newcomers now moved in great numbers into the lower ranks of administrative authority, and they liked the taste of power as well as the status and privileges it brought them. Supervisors, foremen, and managers were needed in the factories, not just workers. Nearly 30 million peasants poured into towns from the countryside during the 1930s, attracted by the chance of increased income, but unaware of their forthcoming subservience to brutal authority. The often unbridled ambitions of low-ranking administrators could be served if they, in turn, served the regime. Ruthlessness for the cause merely mirrored what was happening above them. Despotic managers could, and often did, treat their charges like dirt, knowing that this would bring no sanction, indeed would be welcomed, as long as targets were met. And careers depended on those targets being met. Failure, however arbitrarily it was defined, was too grim to contemplate. It was the core of a system reliant upon millions of little Stalins who made the regime work at the grassroots. Localized rule operated, however, only on a one-way basis, through orders from the top and responsibility from the bottom. Stalin's control of the party apparatus as general secretary ensured rigid centralization of command. All the crucial levers of power and organization were in his hands. A formidable bureaucratic apparatus, more and more at the arbitrary whim of Stalin's growing despotism, but increasing in size despite unbureaucratic inroads into its work, was capable of micromanagement from the very center. Telegrams from Stalin himself dealt even with trivial matters. He could, for instance, order someone in a party or state agency at the other end of the enormous country to supply desperately needed nails to a building site. The party dominated the state in the Soviet Union, and Stalin dominated the party. In fact, his autocracy completely undermined the party's institutional framework of collective rule at the top. The party congress met only twice during the 1930s, in 1934 and again in 1939. The party's central committee, in theory its sovereign body, had become, by the mid-1930s, merely a pliant instrument of Stalin's will. The Politburo, the party's key decision-making body that under Lenin had met weekly, had ever fewer meetings across the 1930s. The membership, once 15 strong, became reduced to a handful of Stalin's closest cronies, the most important of whom was his faithful lapdog Vyacheslav Molotov, who was also chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, in effect, prime minister. This group of loyal lieutenants, their civility to the dictator guaranteed, both by a sense of their own insecurity and by the inducements and rewards of power, played an important role in transmitting and implementing orders in varying spheres of Stalinist rule. Their meetings were often informal, sometimes dinners at Stalin's dacha, or on visits to his holiday residence on the Black Sea. Decisions were rubber-stamped. There was no voting. Often, a decision followed a proposal by Molotov to Stalin, which would be returned with amendments, then dispatched as an order to party offices, or even to the supposedly sovereign state body, the Council of People's Commissars, Sovnarkom. At the grassroots level, Stalin's autocracy prompted a huge turnover of party membership. An army of new party officials replaced the older cadres. They owed their positions to the openings offered to them by the drastic changes in Stalin's revolution from above. This, in turn, encouraged servile acceptance of his untrammeled authority, which was bolstered from the early 1930s onwards by the manufacture of a heroic personality cult around the leader. A Stalin cult had to be built carefully. This wasn't just because the man himself was so physically unprepossessing, diminutive and squat, his face dominated by a big walrus moustache and heavily pitted from smallpox, or that he was a secretive, intensely private individual who spoke in a quiet, undemonstrative voice, his Russian couched in a strong Georgian accent that never left him. The real problem was the giant shadow of Lenin. Stalin couldn't be seen to be usurping the legendary image of the great Bolshevik hero and leader of the revolution. So, at first, Stalin trod cautiously. The celebrations for his 50th birthday in December 1929 brought public eulogies. But the cult was still in its embryonic stages. Stalin professed modesty, publicly disowning attempts to put him on a pedestal with Lenin, and disavowed expressions of personalized devotion. It was no more than a front. Tacitly, he allowed his own elevation amid outright falsification of his role during the revolution, in reality a fairly minor one, first to equal status with Lenin in a sort of dual cult, then to outright supremacy. Untold numbers of minions, time servers, and sycophants rushed to embellish in myriad ways the heroic image of the people's leader. By 1933, there were more than twice as many busts and images of Stalin to be seen in central Moscow than of Lenin. And by now, Stalin, no notable philosopher of Marxism, had been elevated into its preeminent theorist. His works, published in numbers far exceeding those of Marx and Engels, greater even than those of Lenin. When Stalin made a relatively rare public appearance, dressed as usual in his dull party tunic at a Moscow Congress in 1935, the frenetic applause by over 2,000 delegates lasted 15 minutes. As it finally subsided, a woman shouted out, "Glory to Stalin!" And it all began again. Of course, much of the cult was invention. But there was genuine popular resonance as well. Countless ordinary Russians revered him. "The Russian people need a czar," Stalin is alleged to have exclaimed in 1934. A populist father czar evoked for many Soviet citizens, especially for peasants from a countryside still rooted in belief and ritual, the picture of a stern family patriarch, the guarantor of order and the well-being that derived from it. It was undoubtedly an important component of the increasingly all-pervasive Stalin cult. The image of strong, resolute leadership matched the qualities that millions of Soviet citizens yearned for after years of intense upheaval. And though the Soviet Union was officially an atheistic society, traditions deeply embedded in popular religion, 57% of Soviet citizens still claimed to possess religious belief in a 1937 census, later suppressed, encouraged quasi-sacral elements of the Stalin cult, a belief in him as prophet, saviour, or redeemer. The cult doubtless established for Stalin a basis of genuine popularity, even if this can't be quantified. It was of unquestionable importance in consolidating his dominance. But far more important was another factor: fear. Stalin's personal rule rested above all on the precariousness of all subordinate authority, increasingly subject to his arbitrary decisions over life or death. The regime relied primarily upon all-pervasive insecurity that ran throughout Soviet society. This reached new levels altogether during the Great Terror that accompanied the purges of 1937 to 38. Already during the first five-year plan, there had been huge levels of state violence and massive numbers of arrests. Even by 1933, over a million anti-Soviet elements found themselves in camps and prisons. Stalin's extreme displeasure at what he took to be opposition at local level to the drastic pace of economic change led to over 850,000 members being thrown out of the party in 1933. There were tensions high up in the leadership, too. Some party leaders wanted to reduce the pressures on the economy. There were indications that Stalin could no longer depend upon the undiluted backing of the highest echelon of the party. Some pinned their hopes on Sergei Kirov, the popular Leningrad party boss and member of the Politburo. However, in December 1934, Kirov was shot dead in his office in Leningrad. The young assassin, Leonid Nikolaev, had once been associated with Grigory Zinoviev, whose earlier opposition to Stalin and support for Trotsky, by now a demonized arch-enemy, the dictator hadn't forgotten. Nikolaev's motives may well, in fact, have been personal, not political. Kirov had been flirting with Nikolaev's wife, but Stalin was on the lookout for political plots. The assassin was swiftly interrogated, then shot. Whatever the lingering suspicions, Stalin's involvement in the assassination was never proved. But he was quick to turn the murder of Kirov to his own advantage. He gave the state police, NKVD, authority to arrest, try, and execute at will. Zinoviev and Lev Komnenov, who had also earlier supported Trotsky, were sentenced to long periods in prison. More than 30,000 real or supposed opponents in Leningrad were deported to Siberia or other remote areas. Nearly 300,000 party members were expelled over the following 5 months. Stalin's mounting paranoia wouldn't have been lessened if he read police reports soon after Kirov's assassination. "They killed Kirov. We will kill Stalin," was a refrain doing the rounds, along with other expressions of the desirability of getting rid of Stalin. The dictator's suspicions by now knew no bounds. The NKVD told him in 1936 that Trotsky had links from abroad with supporters of Zinoviev, Komnenov, and another former adversary, Nikolai Bukharin. Stalin had Zinoviev and Komnenov taken from prison, retried now in public, the first show trial, for alleged terrorist activities, including assassinations, which had Stalin himself next on the list after Kirov. Zinoviev and Komnenov were sentenced to death and shot in August 1936. These were the first of the early Bolshevik leaders, one-time members of the party's central committee, to be purged, but far from the last. Bukharin's own show trial and inevitable execution were to follow in 1938. Members of the Central Committee themselves now lived in dread, and with good reason. No fewer than 110 out of 139 members deemed unreliable were arrested, a move that usually led to execution or an unenviable fate in the gulag. Also arrested where party and state leaders practically all over the national republics of the Soviet Union. Of 1,966 delegates at the 1934 Party Congress, 1,108 were arrested. Stalin was destroying the Communist Party itself as an independent power base. Managers, scientists, and engineers also fell victim in large numbers to the purges, one reason why economic growth came to an end after 1937. The purges, once unleashed, took on their own momentum. In 1937, the NKVD gave the Politburo a target of 250,000 to be arrested. Over 70,000 would be shot, the rest sentenced to long spells in prison or a labor camp. By the end of 1938, when the purges subsided, possibly because the enormous disruption was damaging industrial production, the target had been massively exceeded. Arrests had reached close to 1.5 million, and nearly 700,000 had been shot. Even the purger-in-chief, Stalin's head of police since 1936, Nikolai Yezhov, nicknamed the Iron Hedgehog, was arrested in 1939 and executed the following year. By 1939, the total number of prisoners in jails and in labor camps and colonies, where conditions were closer to death than life, was almost 3 million. The death rate through starvation, overwork, and arbitrary execution was colossal. Stalin was a deeply vengeful, coldly cruel individual. He even purged his parrot, hitting it on the head with his pipe when its imitation of his crude spitting finally got on his nerves. He was also given to paranoid fantasy. But the paranoia itself fed on developments that did, in fact, give Stalin rational grounds to doubt his own security. Nor was the extraordinary orgy of terror that enveloped the Soviet Union in the 1930s simply an extreme expression of Stalin's paranoia. Millions of ambitious apparatchiks and servile citizens made the terror effective at all levels of society. For every victim, there were winners from the terror, those who profited from serving the regime. Unquestionably, too, there was a widespread belief, encouraged by the regime, that the Soviet Union was infested with wreckers, saboteurs, nationalists, kulaks, spies, and enemy agents. Terror to root out oppositionists was therefore welcomed by many, reinforcing their sense of identification with the epic task of building a socialist society and underpinning their faith in Stalin. Even many who suffered persecution and discrimination desperately sought to belong, associating themselves with Soviet values. Denunciation at all levels was encouraged. The slightest deviationist remark could bring the dreaded knock on the door in the middle of the night. I wake up in the morning and automatically think, "Thank God I wasn't arrested last night," a Leningrad woman entered in her diary in November 1937. They don't arrest people during the day, but what will happen tonight, no one knows. Another Leningrad citizen, a factory worker, would lie awake at night, dreading the sound of a car engine. "They have come for me," his son remembered him saying, whenever he heard a car at night close by. He was convinced that he would be arrested for something he had said. Sometimes at home, he used to curse the Bolsheviks. The arrival of the police was terrifying. Suddenly, several cars would drive into the yard, recalled the son of Osip Piatnitsky, a veteran Bolshevik and once a trusted comrade of Lenin, recounting his father's arrest. Men in uniform and plain clothes would jump out and walk towards staircase entrances. In those days, many people expected to be arrested, but they didn't know when their turn would come. Fear of denunciation made for a silent society. People talk only in secret. Behind the scenes and privately, the only people who express their views in public are the drunks, one man confided to his diary in 1937. Denunciation wasn't necessarily political. It could bring career advancement or direct material rewards. It was also a godsend for settling personal scores, perhaps a conflict with neighbours, a workplace argument, or the breakup of an intimate relationship. An army of informers, some paid or bribed, some blackmailed into cooperation, often simply voluntary collaborators, reported their fellow citizens to the police. Imprisonment, exile, labour camp, or execution invariably followed. The prison population, much of it in ignorance of their crime, represented all sections of society. By 1937-38, no one was safe in Soviet society, from the lowliest peasant to members of the Central Committee. The party elite were, in fact, disproportionately unsafe. Even Stalin enthusiasts could never be sure that at some point the nocturnal hammering on the door wouldn't be for them. Stalin's mounting anxiety about the looming danger to the Soviet Union might well have lain behind the outright explosion of terror in the Great Purges. Sensing fascist spies and enemies everywhere as an immense fifth column within his own country, Stalin left no stone unturned in the attempt to eradicate all internal opposition before war could strike. Ethnic minorities close to Soviet borders were subjected to mass deportations and executions. Poles, along with many Belarusians and Ukrainians regarded with suspicion, in the western regions of the Soviet Union were particularly endangered. Fearing Poland would join with Hitler's Germany in attacking the Soviet Union, in August 1937, Stalin ordered the roundup of 140,000 Soviet Poles who were either shot or sent to labor camps over the following months. Nor did Stalin spare the Red Army. With deepening awareness of the threat from both West and East, Hitler's Germany and Japan had come together in signing an anti-Comintern pact in November 1936. The last thing he needed, it might have been thought, was any disturbance to the strengthening of the Red Army. Astonishingly, however, in 1937-38, Stalin practically demolished his military high command. The most outstanding strategist, Mikhail Tukhachevsky, who had earlier more than once crossed Stalin, was arrested, forced into a confession of conspiring to overthrow the Soviet Union, and executed. Over 30,000 officers in all were purged, at least 20,000 executed. The higher the rank, the greater was the likelihood of arrest. The decapitation of the Red Army left it gravely weakened under the command of the incompetent Stalinist favourite, Kliment Voroshilov, and in no position to contemplate a major war. In recognition of the alarming gap to be made up, Soviet defence expenditure increased at a frenetic pace in the later 1930s, rising from 9.7%, just short of 5,400 million rubles, to 25.6%, 39,200 million rubles, of the state budget between 1934 and 1939. As it did so, material conditions for Soviet citizens, which had improved somewhat during the second five-year plan of 1933-37, again fell sharply. Measures to extract higher delivery quotas of agricultural produce, increase taxes, and intensify work on the collective farms were hugely unpopular in the countryside. Urban workers were outraged at restrictive labour laws introduced in 1938. This was no popular dictatorship. There were many committed individuals, idealists and ideological zealots, to be sure, but the population at large, beyond the real or feigned Stalin worshippers and regime enthusiasts, was cowed into truculent quiescence. There were no major disturbances or displays of unrest, and, so far as is known, there was never an attempt to kill Stalin. He was loved by many, but feared by far more. Terror had done its job. terror was the defining characteristic of Stalin's regime. Never before had any government terrorized so many of its own people so wantonly and callously. Mussolini's Italy, the totalitarian dream.